It's a Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. You have just 7 days left to decide which candidates to vote for in the midterm election. Voters go to the polls 1 week from today on November 4th. One key race involves candidates for the U.S. House seat in the 12th Congressional District, which covers six counties, all of Beaver, Southern Lawrence, Northern Allegheny, Northern Westmoreland, Southern Cambria, and Northern Somerset. The seat has been filled for one term by Republican incumbent Keith Rothfuss of Sewickley. We have invited Congressman Rothfuss to be on the program and are awaiting his reply. Today, we are joined by his challenger in the 12th District, Democratic candidate Erin McClelland of Harrison. She joins us now in Studio A. Erin McClelland, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, Erin McClelland, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. If you're curious about what stands she is taking on different issues, email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Erin McClelland, you bring a certain expertise in health care to this race. It's an issue you're passionate about. Explain where that comes from.
Where my passion from health care comes from?
Yes.
Well, that's what I've always done. It's what my mom did. And it's even what my great-grandmother did. They were nurses. So I have a long history of people that worked in the healthcare field. And I went into it from a little bit of a different angle. I chose to go into behavioral health. It's an area that I've been interested in a very long time. Watching a growing drug problem in this area really got me fascinated with it. Because not only is it an issue that I find interesting, but it's also something that is really affecting our communities a lot. And I saw it a lot when I was in school. And so that was where it started for me. And then working in it and working my way up and seeing it from a number of different levels, from the provider level I was a researcher for a while and even did some policy work here in Pittsburgh, as well as some Office of National Drug Control policy work. So I've seen it from a lot of different angles. And it's a fascinating issue that we have. It's our number one most expensive preventable healthcare issue. So it's something that we really need to take care of.
And what do you think specifically in that area needs to be addressed? I know that you have a background in drug treatment. Talk about that and how you feel that the problem on a larger scale needs to be addressed.
It needs to be addressed on so many different levels, and it's not. We don't really have good local policies for it, for controlling it, for even just understanding and educating people on what this issue looks like. Too many people still really regard it as something that only happens to minorities or to poor people, and that's just not the case. On more of a statewide level, there's a lot of things that we have to address as far as how we fund it. Another thing that we have going on statewide is we are seeing cuts across the board for insurance services that are reimbursing drug and alcohol and mental health. And that's a huge problem that we're seeing. Is this is sort of the unwanted stepchild of the healthcare industry. And then on a national level, you see everything from how drugs are coming into the country, how we're doing a drug control policy that is more based on criminalization than control. And that is failing epically. We have probably the worst drug control policy of any industrialized nation. We're just getting it wrong over and over again. And it's costing us a lot of money, and it's completely ineffective. So I think every level this problem needs addressed, and just nobody really talks about it.
There has been a lot of discussion at the state level about medical marijuana. This is more of a, you know, lately it's been more of a state issue in Pennsylvania. But what is your feeling about medical marijuana? Is it something that you believe should be legalized?
Absolutely. And the reason for that is we actually have pharmaceutical drugs that are much more systemically damaging, far more addictive to treat the things that medical marijuana can treat. And the evidence shows that it is very effective at treating things like glaucoma. It's a great anti-inflammatory for issues like Crohn's disease. It helps a lot to relieve symptoms of cancer treatments. So the evidence is there to substantiate that. It is a non-addictive drug. It's one that doesn't do a lot of systemic damage because it's completely natural. So I'm a supporter of it. I think it's a lot better than some of the pharmaceutical grade things that we're using out there to treat those issues.
And you also have started a nonprofit business specializing in addiction treatment. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I started out in regular drug and alcohol, and I've worked the gamut in that, you know, drug-free outpatient there. I did some work in a methadone clinic for a while, and I saw the way it's done, and I got really frustrated because what we tend to do is take people that are suffering with this issue, we put them in a room with 20 other addicts, and we make them talk about being an addict for about an hour. And then when we're done, we tell them, okay, this was treatment. And I think that's absurd because all they really want to do at the end of an hour of talking about using drugs is go do drugs. And I didn't really understand that. Another thing that I never understood about the way we do it in a traditional setting is these people do a lot of damage to their bodies. When you're putting large amounts of drugs in your body over a period of time, it does do damage. In addition to that, they don't tend to be taking care of themselves. They're not eating well. They're not exercising. They're hardly drinking, you know, water. They're usually drinking a lot of soda and really bad foods. So I always saw that it was more complicated than just putting people in a room and talking about it. So I studied under former Treasury Secretary O'Neill the idea of root cause analysis in healthcare, solving problems at their root cause. So I started looking at this issue, and I wanted to find the root cause of it. So I opened a program and got it licensed that did that very thing. We started doing a lot of testing on our patients to see what they were experiencing and what their problems were. And one of the things that we did find is that 100% of our patients that were putting large amounts of drugs in their body actually experienced a lot of gastrointestinal distress. Every single one of them had some level of problems going on there. And what we found is that when you put a lot of drugs in the body, the liver can only process it out so fast. So you start to get a backup and it affects the entire GI tract. So that was one of the things that we found early on. It affects your ability to absorb, you know, nutrients and things like that, which deteriorates mental health and physical health. So what we started doing is working on getting all the garbage out of their system and getting them moving forward in a healthy way so they could really eat normal and start exercising and feel better. That was the focus that I was putting on. If we could make people feel good without drugs as they did with them, then we were getting somewhere. So that was the goal that I had.
And how did you approach it from a psychological standpoint, from the mental health aspect? You have, as I understand, a pretty extensive background, particularly in psychology.
Sure.
So how did that come into play? And how does it come into play in your work?
Well, it's obviously a huge part of it because you're talking about human behavior. And when you're talking about a pattern that people have when they feel alone or desperate or scared or in pain, you have to really work on the behavioral component. So obviously that's still a huge issue in it.
We are talking with Democratic candidate for the U.S. House seat in the 12th Congressional District, Erin McClellan, here in Studio A. She is up against the incumbent Republican, Keith Rothfuss, who has also been invited to join us at some point on this program before the election. We have not yet had a response from him. You can join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Let's go to George in Pittsburgh. George, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You are on with congressional candidate Erin McClellan.
Hello.
Hello, George. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, Ellen, I'm curious. It sounds like you have some experience in the background of health care. I'd like to get a further understanding of your economic background. You know, have you ever met a payroll before? Are you familiar with the landscape of business in our region, the quality of the jobs that we have today versus part-time jobs, et cetera? But it's interesting to me, and I think to a lot of people who are out here in this economy today, and we really are looking for leaders who have experience in fulfilling economic challenges that are out there. So
specifically, what are you referring to? Job creation, George? Is that your concern here? Or
yes, it is.
Okay,
everything. I mean, job creation is what funds all these tax program, all these programs that are paid for by our taxes. So I'm looking for leaders who, number one, have led through economic development situations before. Have you met a payroll before? Have you built a business? Have you actually been a job creator?
Okay, let's let Aaron respond. Go ahead.
Thanks for your question, George. And the answer is yes. I started my program about 7 years ago. I actually wrote a business plan for it, got it licensed by the state, got a lot of investment for it. And yes, had to meet payroll, had to get it insured, had to get my employees health insurance and, you know, accommodate the IRS and all those fun things that you have to do whenever you're running a small business. So, yes, absolutely. I've done all those things. And yes, we did create jobs. So, yeah, I have a history of that. And it's something I'm very passionate about.
George, thank you for that call. And again, you can respond or join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Email, by the way, ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. I understand, Aaron McClellan, that one of your pet causes is reducing medical errors. Explain how you would go about doing that.
It's actually a pretty simple process. The reason I dive into medical errors is because we have a big debate going on about healthcare. And this is our number one financial problem. It's $60 trillion in unfunded liabilities. So it is the number one biggest financial problem our country has. And we have this debate going on about how we solve those unfunded liabilities and how we reduce the cost of healthcare that's growing out of control. Instead of having that fight ongoing and not moving us anywhere, let's look at some of the things that are exploding costs. And one of those things, and one of the biggest things, is medical errors. We have 300 million of them every year. And every day we kill enough people to fill 2 to 3 jumbo jets in our healthcare system. You know, these are people that are dying unnecessarily.
Do we know why that's happening or why the errors are being made and what they are?
Sure. Usually they're system level errors. They can be something as simple as an illegible prescription. They can be a hospital acquired infection. You know, there's any number of things that can happen where somebody makes a mistake.
And why is that happening? Do you think?
You know what? I think a lot of it has to do with you have systems in place that aren't always followed. And sometimes those systems aren't streamlined well enough to make sure that you resolve errors and make sure they don't happen again. We tend to have a medical system that is a little overburdened and people are still working long hours. They're overwhelmed. They're in sort of a crisis response a lot of times. So they're taking shortcuts. And even with this Ebola issue, what we saw is medical professionals dropping universal precautions, you know, taking shortcuts. That happens all too often and we see it a lot and that ends up leading to death. So what we need to do, and sometimes it's not even a medical professional's fault. Sometimes it's simply they misread a packaging, you know, or two things looked alike. I actually saw a medical error where somebody used the wrong type of tubing on a patient because the two types of tubing were packaged exactly the same. So we called the manufacturer and said, can you make one red and one blue so we don't make that mistake anymore? So sometimes it's visual errors and sometimes it's like I said, legible errors where they can't read something.
Is it because of there's not enough thoroughness because of understaffing, because of there's not thorough enough and extensive instruction?
No, and those are all possibilities, but usually it's simply that the system isn't streamlined enough. You don't have a good enough process. If you look at the way we build a car, there is a very streamlined process. There are very specific ways that you go through an assembly line. We don't see it that specific in healthcare. And if we could streamline process, we could actually eliminate medical errors at root cause. And that's something I've actually done. I actually went into healthcare settings and showed healthcare providers how to take an error, identify it, solve it to root cause, and make sure it never happens again for that reason. It's a pretty simple process. It is leadership-based. It's making sure that people are accountable and transparent. But you can't have transparency unless you do it in a blame-free environment. A nurse needs to feel comfortable coming forward saying, I made a mistake, and we need to fix it right now. A, we need to go and make sure that patient is taken care of because there was a medical error. B, we need to make sure what happened and solve it to root cause so it doesn't happen again. So you can't do that in a blame-ridden environment where people are afraid they're going to be punished or suspended or have their pay docked because people do make mistakes. We all know it. There's 300 million mistakes every year. So let's just create an environment where a professional can come forward and say, look, I messed up. And I feel terrible about it, but can we protect this patient and make sure they're okay? Right now, we have an environment that's very blame-ridden, so people hide those errors. And what ends up happening is the patient isn't protected quickly. The error isn't resolved to root cause, and we have no systemic learning. We're not getting better every day, and we need to be improving every single day if we really want to have the gold standard of healthcare in this country and reduce the costs that are associated with those errors.
Your opponent in this race, Keith Rothfuss, has voted a number of times to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Where do you stand on Obamacare?
I stand on the idea that we need healthcare reform. We absolutely have to have it. And almost every president for 70 years has tried some form of healthcare reform because we need it. The numbers show we need it. The data shows that we need it. There is no argument that we need healthcare reform in this country. You cannot like the way it was done. And there's certainly things that I would love to change about the way it was done. It's not the way I would have done it. But
what would you have done differently?
I would have started with the medical errors. I would have started there. I would have started with process improvement and then done the mandate of coverage later once you got the cost savings in the system through performance improvement.
And you feel that that would have saved enough to lower the cost?
Oh, yeah. The data is inarguable over and over again. We've seen study after study after study that shows that we can save nearly $1 trillion a year by eliminating medical errors. It's about $100 billion for every 10% reduction you see. So, yes, if you start reducing medical errors immediately, you would start to save money immediately, and in no time at all, you could start to use that money, transfer it to covering the cost of the uninsured, which is another big problem in our healthcare system when we're reallocating the cost of our uninsured in a very, very irrational and ineffective way. But we've made a decision that we are not going to let our sick and dying die in the street. We are going to treat them, whether they have insurance or not. And that burden is right now going on to our healthcare system, and particularly in our emergency rooms. And that's not the most effective, efficient way to administer care. We need to get people in the primary care setting.
So let's say you, hypothetically, let's go with the idea that you win the election and that you're in Congress, and more than likely in the House, at least, you're going to be in the minority. The Democrats are going to be in the minority. And, these votes keep coming up to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So, if and when you're in Congress and those votes come up, how would you address that? How would you address that issue? And would you approach it from the standpoint that we can't simply repeal the Affordable Care Act, we need to tweak it? And then if that's the answer, then if so, how?
Sure. And it'll depend on what's being put in front of me, because the votes to repeal.
Yeah. Let's say it's a vote to repeal.
Just totally repeal. No, yep. I'm not going to vote for that, because we have to keep moving forward. And we have seen in the Social Security and Medicare Trustees report, which came out in August, it has said that we have actually started to see significant cost reductions as a result of the Affordable Care Act. We have over 8 million people that are now covered. We have young people under the age of 26. And it is really important that those people are in the system, because they tend to be healthy. And that means that they're paying into the system and they're healthy, which they're not draining the system. What we tend to have now is only sick people and elderly people in the system. And that is not how insurance should work. That's not the way car insurance works, where you only have the people that are driving badly in the system. The whole system would fail if it was that way. You have good drivers in it too. So we need to do the same thing with healthcare. We need young people in the system, because they need to be paying into it now, so later on when they're sick, we have a balanced system. And that we don't have. So I would support maintaining it. Like I said, it's not the way I would have done it, but it's the way it was done. And we need to keep moving it forward. We need to solve any glitches in it. And we need to make sure that we get people covered in this country. We need to make sure that we have free market principles in our healthcare system, which the Affordable Care Act does. We have no transparency right now in healthcare. You have no idea when you go into a hospital how well their outcomes are on cardiac surgery or transplants. They don't have to tell you that. As a matter of fact, most people don't even ask before they go to get their blood drawn or go to get a procedure done. They don't ask how much it costs. We don't have those principles. And a procedure in one hospital can cost you $7,000, and the same procedure elsewhere can cost you $70,000.
So there needs to be more transparency, particularly as it relates to cost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The average person uses more pieces of data to pick a restaurant than they do to pick a healthcare provider. And the number one piece of data that they look at when they choose a healthcare provider is the parking.
Interesting. A number of Republican and some Democratic politicians are calling for closing the borders in the wake of the Ebola scare. If you had a seat in Congress right now, what would you be calling for?
I would be calling for people to, and this is what I have been saying, this is in the realm of the CDC right now. We have had three people infected in this country with Ebola. This is an issue that is, or a health issue that is not airborne. And people are acting as if it is. Yet every year, 70,000 people die of health issues that are very similar to Ebola. And nobody says a word about it. We don't talk about it at all. Healthcare professionals catching these bugs in the hospital because they drop universal precautions. Nobody says a word. But because now we want to look at it right before an election as a political issue when three people were infected, we want to close borders. Well, what about the other 70,000? We don't care about them, you know, when we're not running for office. And I think it's pretty
So you feel it's being politicized?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the CDC is an unbelievable organization. I have been on their website on a weekly basis through my entire healthcare career. The work they do is phenomenal. These are some of the best and brightest. They put themselves in very dangerous situations every day. They are going to foreign countries, exposing themselves to horrible things. And they do it to protect the world. They are 911 for this planet. And you have people, they're underfunded all the time. They work with what they can get. And all of a sudden, when something like this happens, we put them in a hearing and start stringing people up. We ignore them 364 days out of the year, completely blow off all the hard work they do, the extraordinary things they do. They have stopped every Ebola outbreak, every single one in history. This is not that hard to do, but you have to do it at the source. Closing the borders actually is going to make it more difficult for us to solve this problem at root cause, to get professionals to Africa to do what they need to do to address the problem and stop it in its tracks there. These travel bans that they're talking about, which the CDC does have level 2 and 3 travel bans in place. And when they feel it is medically necessary to escalate those, they will. But let's keep these bureaucrats and big government politicos out of this process. Let these professionals do their job. Let them move forward and stop intervening in a political fashion. They know what they're doing. They're some of the best out there. Let them do their job. They will protect the American people and stay out of it. That's how I feel about it.
We're talking with Erin McClellan. She is the Democratic candidate for the U.S. House seat in the 12th Congressional District. She is challenging Republican Congressman, incumbent Congressman Keith Rothfuss. And we have just a couple minutes left. And so since we're short on time, I'm going to go with a couple last questions for you. One is your opponent, Congressman Rothfuss, voted with the Republicans in the House a year ago to shut down the government. In your opinion, was that a good or bad decision on his part?
It was a horrible decision. It was horrible and it was irresponsible. And I was running a business at the time. And I was going through, we were converting our business to a nonprofit. So I was paying an accountant, an attorney, to help us go through that process. And I couldn't get a hold of anybody. Nobody. Because the whole government was shut down. That's not the way this works. We don't elect people to go to Washington so they can shut down the government and go hang out in a coffee shop for 3 weeks and cost the American people $24 billion. This was an act that solved no problem, created no solution, and cost us a whole bunch of money and furloughed all these government employees. It is absolutely absurd. It didn't solve anything for us. It was a big temper tantrum over the Affordable Care Act. And you know what? I'm sure there's been a lot of laws that the Democrats would like to shut down here and there over history. But they're not shutting down the government because they want to repeal a piece of legislation. This is not the way this country works. This is not the way our legislative process works. And I was stunned that they did it. And Mr. Rothfuss did say in the Post-Gazette Ed, that in the Ed Board interview, that he may not, or he may do it again. He didn't say that he was against shutting it down again.
One last question. I described the district and all that the 12th district covers at the top of this segment. How can you best represent such a diverse and oddly shaped district as you could potentially be representing?
It's actually not as tough as most people would think, because these are blue-collar people. That's what you see. There's not a lot of millionaires in this district. There's not even a lot of big corporations. It's just blue-collar people, a lot of small businesses. And I come from a small town, and I come from a town that's in this district. I was born and raised in it. So I know this area top to bottom, and I've felt very, very comfortable from Cambria and Somerset County up to Beaver, and I feel like I understand their issues.
Let me jump in. Explain why, okay, these are blue-collar people, they're not millionaires, and how does that make it easier?
For me?
Yeah.
Because I'm just like them. Unlike Mr. Rothfuss, who's not from Western Pennsylvania originally and is a millionaire. And
should we hold that against him?
I don't hold it against him. I just don't think that he understands what they're going through. I don't think he relates very well to their problems. When you look at things that he's done, like shutting down the government or even voting against hurricane relief for hurricane victims, when you drive through this district, you see rivers and a lot of them flood. So to stand up and say that you weren't going to support flood relief for the Hurricane Sandy victims is appalling. When you look at this district, you see a district that is predominantly women, and he voted against the Violence Against Women Act. So I just don't think that he is looking at the district for what it is and who's in it and the problems that we experience every day. I think he's very detached. So I think if you grow up in this district and you understand how people think and how they feel and the problems they see every day, it's a lot easier to represent them. And I haven't found it to be that complicated.
Democratic candidate for the U.S. House in the 12th Congressional District, Erin McClellan, joining us in Studio A. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
And we did extend an invitation to Republican incumbent Congressman Keith Rothfuss to join us on this program anytime between now and Election Day. We are awaiting his response. Coming up, we'll find out which places in the Pittsburgh region the Young Preservationist Association wants to save from the wrecking ball. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.